Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over 71 million Americans have voted for authoritarianism, mass deportation, forced birth, and a promise to prosecute the, quote, enemy from within. We are still waiting for all of the votes to be counted, but so far, Donald Trump has 51% of the popular vote. The Guardian reports that the Democrats won 2020 by expanding their share of votes across the country, but 90% of counties swung back to the Republicans last night. They even made inroads in blue states. The Republican Party has also taken control of the Senate. We are still waiting on results for the House. Seven states supported abortion rights measures, but some of those same states elected anti-abortion Republicans. So given all we know about Donald Trump and today's Republican Party, what explains this? How are you processing last night's results? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He has written many, many books. His latest book, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is the New York Times bestseller, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Hi, John. Thank you so much for joining us again.
It is an honor to be with you and with Michelle.
Thank you. We're joined also by Professor Michelle Goodwin, Chair in Constitutional Law and Global Health Policy at Georgetown Law School and co-faculty director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health. Dr. Goodwin is host of the podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin and author of many books, including Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Hi, Professor Goodwin. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be back on with you, and hello to you too, John.
We've been on twice today, I think, together.
That's right.
Yes, I heard you both on Democracy Now! This morning. Thank you so much. And I'm also so pleased that we have a third guest with us. We just booked Kristen Anaya yesterday, and Kristen has such an important story to share with everyone. I'll just give a brief overview, and then Kristen, I'd love to start with you because this is all... Well, it's so personal for everyone, but really also for you. Kristen became pregnant after Texas banned abortion in 2022. At 16 and a half weeks, her water broke and she began to lose amniotic fluid. Although she was told by doctors that her pregnancy could not continue, she also could not receive an abortion as her unborn daughter still had a heartbeat. Her doctors were only able to receive permission from an ethics commission to provide her an abortion after she became septic and her life was in danger. Kristen spent 22 hours in the hospital with a high fever, shaking uncontrollably and vomiting before receiving an abortion. It took her another 5 days in the hospital to recover from the sepsis infection. Kristen Anaya was one of the plaintiffs in Zorosky versus the state of Texas. This was that case brought by a group of women who sued the state of Texas to compel it to clarify the medical exemption to its abortion ban. In May, the Texas Supreme Court refused to issue a clarification. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I thought about you and all of the brave women that have shared their stories and joined that lawsuit against Texas. When I saw the results from Texas come in, when I saw that Ted Cruz is once again the senator of Texas, and then these national results, how are you making sense of this, Kristen, given that we know 80% of this country supports abortion rights?
Yeah, I agree. I think we were all shocked too. Myself and Art and a lot of the co-plaintiffs were on a group text together. And last night, you know, we were just in shock, very sad, numb, you know, to feel so ignored is a very hard thing to explain. We all personally deal with people in our personal lives that are have even voted against women's rights by voting the way that they did in this election. And particularly, you know, Ted Cruz, I'm just completely shocked that we chose, that the people of Texas chose to vote him in again for another 6 years. And and also the Supreme Court justices. So of the 9 Supreme Court justices in Texas, 3 of them, 3 of their seats were up for election. And, you know, we rallied hard to try to unseat them, and we failed there as well, too. So just across the board, just a complete disappointment for us.
And Ted Cruz won by almost a million votes.
Yeah, almost a million votes. Yep, it's unbelievable.
Kristen, what do you think? I mean, we're going to talk about this for months to come about how this happened. But what do you think explains this, especially when you think about what has happened with Roe? And again, 80%, just the support for reproductive rights has actually gone up since the overturning of Roe.
Yeah, it has. I think that, you know, Roe was overturned so long ago that it wasn't an issue of we didn't have time to get our stories out and in front of people. We had the time to do that. And so I think that's one of the reasons that I'm so shocked. It's not like a lot of people can now say that they haven't heard of these issues. I think we do still run into people that haven't heard of these issues, but it's fewer and far between. So people know what's happening. I think that there is, based on what I hear people saying against us, I think that there's still skepticism amongst people that haven't been in our shoes and that refuse to listen and believe what's happening behind those closed doors in the hospital room with our doctors. There's still skepticism that it's the doctor's fault, which we know is untrue. These doctors' lawyers know what they're doing. They know what's on the line, and they know that what they have to do to make sure they're within the law. But there's still a lot of people that are skeptical that this is the doctors trying to make a point or what have you. And, you know, for lots of reasons, doctors, you know, are cautious about coming forward on this type of stuff. It's a tough situation to be in. And so I think with a combination of people just still not believing that the law truly prevents the doctors from providing care in life-saving situations, coupled with, you know, obviously the economy and immigration, that platform that the Republicans have been able to run so hard on, I think that it just wasn't, that people just didn't take it as seriously as we had hoped for, and honestly that we anticipated for. I was shocked. I mean, I think that, like I said, we had enough time to get our stories out there. People know what's happening, and we still have been ignored.
Well, we've been talking for many months about tragic, tragic stories of women who have lost their lives because of the overturning of Roe and these extreme Republican abortion bans. Kavita Serrano, a reporter with ProPublica who's done excellent but has written devastating stories about women who've died in Texas and Georgia, was on our show yesterday talking about this. I mean, 60 Minutes did a piece on Sunday, although I noticed in a very long 60 Minutes piece, they never once mentioned the word Republican in a piece about devastating abortion bans. So again, these are the things that we're going to be talking about for months to come. Kristen, before we go to our other guests, Dr. Goodwin and John Nichols, I just wonder, what are you hearing from the other women who have so bravely shared their stories about what happened after they became pregnant? What are you hearing about Ted Cruz winning again and then what is happening at the national level? How are they doing this morning?
Yeah, I mean, we've been texting all night, all morning, and we're just not okay. I mean, I posted on Instagram about 2 a.m., and just said, you know, women have been ignored, betrayed, and not valued. And that's how we're all feeling this morning. And it's not going to end, but we all also agree that we're stronger together, and we are not going to give up, and we are going to keep fighting. The battle just became harder. We have a lot of things stacked against us now. And, you know, we're probably going to have to, in my opinion, my personal opinion, I think we're going to have to rethink how we go at this. How do we get doctors to mobilize? How do we get One of the ladies on the text with us this morning said, how do we get companies to mobilize like Bumble has done? And so I think we're going to have to get, because the fight just got larger, right? Because there's so much stacked against us. I think we're going to have to start really thinking outside of the box, because sharing our stories is clearly not enough.
I'm so sorry. Kristen Anaya is joining us from Texas. She and so many other women shared their stories about what happened after they became pregnant, after Texas banned abortion. And you can read, there's so many stories about Kristen out there. She joined that lawsuit, Zurawski versus the state of Texas. And Texas politicians have just gone hard against these women. The Texas Supreme Court refused to issue a medical clarification. We're also joined today by Dr. Michelle Goodwin, and we've had Dr. Goodwin on the show many times talking about abortion. She's the author of the really important book, Policing the Womb. Professor Goodwin, how are you making sense of this, given the stories that Kristen and others, you have shared your personal story? You wrote that really amazing, devastating op-ed in the New York Times about your own story. So on this issue, given that this issue has so much support, and yet it's head spinning because these abortion amendments passed in many cases, seven of them, but then the same people elected anti-choice extreme Republicans.
Yeah, I thank you so much for that. And it's a pleasure to be back with you. Even in light of these circumstances, I think that, you know, this morning there are many Black women across the country that wake up to a reality that intergenerationally they've known. You know, I was just saying to a group, I think about Ruby Bridges' mom, mm-hmm. who wanted to show something to America, to test something with America, to say, United States, you have a constitution that is lauded. You speak of democracy and equality and liberty and freedom. But I have to test this out with you, with my six-year-old daughter surrounded by guards, so that images of this can be deeply embedded, such that we can test that against what the Constitution, how the Constitution is applied. And I think about this within a context of your question. So how could there be people, women, including white women, who would vote to protect and preserve reproductive freedom for themselves and their daughters, but not necessarily think about these other important matters of democracy, constitutionalism, liberty, equality, etc., for others in these spaces? I realize that this morning that there are many pundits that are saying that, look, what people were most concerned about were matters of the economy, or matters of immigration. And while those things hold true, there is a concern about a history that we continue to deny in our country, where we've not had the truth and reconciliation that has taken shape in Germany, that is taking place in South Africa. I mean, after a lingering history, centuries of American enslavement and then Jim Crow, we were saved by the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, save for those two very powerful pieces of federal legislation that were pushed into being because of folks like Ruby Bridges' mom and Dr. King and others. Who's to say what our nation would look like right now? And so to divorce a conversation about reproductive rights and those ballot initiatives from what is that lingering history, I think would be a mistake. And yet it's very, very difficult for Americans to have mature, informed, honest conversations about that. We run from it. In fact, we run so much from it that today we have books being banned in states like Alabama and Arkansas, et cetera, that were not banned 60 years ago. Yeah. That's how much we run from these histories.
I think that you bring up such a great point. And when you talk to the people, the overwhelming majority do not agree with these book bans. And yet the same Republicans that are supporting these book bans just won re-election.
Yes, that's exactly right. And of course, ultimately, what these harms do is they affect us all. And that's also been the challenge of our inability to engage with these histories. What does it mean to us morally, culturally? And in fact, even what does that mean to us economically? You know, what does it mean to have a future where populations in the United States are less informed about their own histories, you know, and we neglect the fact that in other parts of the world, they learn about U.S. history, right? So they know about these various things when our own kids will grow up ignorant about matters of Jim Crow, slavery, the Holocaust, women's rights, indigenous people, and so forth. I mean, it's not as if the rest of the world isn't looking. Right. The rest of the world does, in fact, look, and we have to be brave enough. Right? Brave enough to encounter these things. And when we are, we create better futures for everyone. I think that of the many concerns of this recent election happens to be the vitriol and the hate that targeted immigrant communities. And it's interesting when you think about it in connection with people and their concern about the cost of food. But who are the people that are picking the tomatoes and picking the grapes and picking the oranges and working in the meat packing plants that have helped to subsidize the costs of American food? But it's a connection that isn't made. And I have to say, we have to do a much better job at this nuance in how we report, because I don't think that that's been lifted up enough.
That is Professor Michelle Goodwin, Chair in Constitutional Law and Global Health Policy at Georgetown Law School. She's the author of many books, including Policing the Womb. We're also joined by John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. John, you've been at this for a very long time. You've written so many books about the political system, the state of the media. How are you processing this? How are you making sense of this?
Not easily. It's an interesting thing that a decent amount of my processing has occurred in conversations like this, interviews and conversations with friends and colleagues. I think, you know, that's how we sort through everything at a human level. When something overwhelming occurs, we should never withdraw. Right. I mean, we may want to find a moment of solitude, but at the end of the day, we have to open up dialogue, to start listening to each other more, to make those deeper connections. This conversation we are having right here has already illuminated me in so many ways, and frankly, you know, made me vaguely more hopeful, because I hear people who I respect greatly talking about how to resist, how to push back, and what to do. But truthfully, the way that I process things like this is as something of a historian. You know, certainly not as able as many other folks, but somebody who's written a lot of history. And I will tell you, I don't like the phrase "we've been here before," right? Because that diminishes the trauma of the moment or the difficulty of the moment. But I do think it's important to understand that this country has been deeply divided and has done the wrong thing many, many times, and has produced election results that are, you know, not just troublesome, but really are, as I suggested, overwhelming. In another context, in 1980, when I was much younger, I was, you know, susceptible to the media that said that it's almost impossible that an actor from California, Ronald Reagan, is going to get elected president of the United States. And in 1980, Ronald Reagan got elected president of the United States. And he didn't just get elected, right? It was by a wide margin, much more comfortable than expected. And he flipped the Senate, bringing in a group of very right-wing senators and moving out a lot of the most distinguished, progressive Democratic senators. But he didn't take the House. And at the end of the day, progressives rebuilt from that place. Not as I would have, not in every way that I would have liked to have seen. The labor, environmental, social justice, civil rights activists built an opposition. It was not easy. Out of that opposition came the candidacy in 1984. In 1988, the Reverend Jesse Jackson Jr. for president. And out of that candidacy came many new visions for organizing and for doing a different kind of politics, the vision of the rainbow, et cetera. Bernie Sanders to this day says that he was hugely influenced by the rainbow. So we see that connection coming right up to the present moment. And so, you know, in a moment like this, I think about, you know, the calculations and the calculus to build a resistance that is respectful. It isn't just about politics, it's not just about policy. It's respectful of the very real human needs that we're hearing about in this broadcast right here, but that we know exist on so many other levels. And so when I talk about that, and it's the last thing I'll say on this, and certainly, you know, hope we go to many more good questions, but when I talk about building such an opposition, I think it's within the realm of possibility here. The Senate has been lost, obviously the White House. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with the House of Representatives. It is possible that the Democrats will have a narrow majority there. If they do, that is very significant. But at the bottom line, people must organize across the country to pressure not just Democrats, but a handful of Republicans to do the right thing. Will that win at every turn? No. Politics produces many disappointments. But that organizing, that building grows into something. And I think that at this point, building new initiatives is very, very important. A. Philip Randolph, who's, you know, my great hero, he got into politics during World War I at a point where he was an anti-war socialist when the whole country was organizing for a war. It was unbelievably difficult. They tried to put him in jail. He worked through the 1920s. It was unbelievably difficult because conservative Republicans were in charge of almost everything. He took charge of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He kept organizing, building things. He finally got into the office of Franklin Roosevelt and threatened to march on Washington. Roosevelt integrated the defense industries. He got into the office of Harry Truman, threatened to march on Washington, and Truman integrated the military. He got into the office of Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, and Eisenhower and Nixon began to move on a host of civil rights initiatives, but they didn't move far enough. And finally, he got into the office of John Kennedy, and he said, boy, if we don't get a Civil Rights Act, we're going to do this march on Washington, the one that didn't happen in the past. They did it. And it was transformational in our politics. What I'm going to tell you is, no matter who's in charge, Democrats or Republicans, we have to have that A. Philip Randolph sensibility. And that is that there are some issues that go above party, above partisanship, and go to moral necessity. And I think we are in a moral necessity organizing moment. And even as I talk about it, I feel a measure of hope and even excitement.
Kristen, I know we have to let you go. Before we do, this is a tough question to ask you. How far do you think Trump and the Republicans will go on abortion? It was interesting last night on MSNBC, Lawrence O'Donnell said, and he's been in Washington for many years, he said, the Republicans are reading the outcome of these seven amendments. And we should also say the media is reporting that the amendments did not pass, the abortion measures, I should say, did not pass in Florida, South Dakota, and Nebraska. But they also need to let people know that in Florida, you need 60% for a ballot measure to pass. And they were just under that. I was curious about where this came from. And from Tampa Bay 10, I learned that in 2006, an amendment raised the threshold for voter approval to 60%. At the time, Florida lawmakers and large business groups said it was too easy to change the state's amendment, and they pushed for the higher voter approval threshold. Ironically, that passed with just 57% of the vote. So that's where we are. Media really need to let people know that it didn't just go down in Florida. It got almost 60%, but not enough. So that's really important. So Lawrence O'Donnell said, because these amendments passed, he said Republicans are not going to touch abortion. And others on the panel disagreed and said, oh, yes, they will. What do you think they're going to do? Because they don't, even if the Democrats keep the House, they could use the Comstock Act without congressional action to ban abortion nationwide.
Right. Yeah. Thanks for the question. Yeah. I too, on Florida, it was so disappointing. It's almost like, ignore the fact that 60%, you know, when you hear 60%, it's like, okay, 60% of the vote. But when I saw those numbers on paper last night, and 6 million Florida residents voted yes, and only 4.5 voted no, wow. that hits different, so to speak. You know, when I heard 60% initially, I was thinking, okay, yeah, they'll get 60%. But then when you see it in numbers, that was really hard to digest. Like, we have to stop, sit back and think about the fact that 6 million people that live in Florida felt that we should, that reproductive freedom should be restored in Florida. And that's still important to remember. I think it's funny your question, because I talked to one of my best girlfriends this morning who called to check on me, and we were having this exact conversation. And, you know, I told her about the Trump administration, and I told her, I said, even though my only positivity out of the last, you know, 12 hours or so has been the ballot measures that have passed. But at the same time, we're moving forward with the Trump administration, who, like you said, there's other means by which they can, you know, pass something at the federal level. And I personally don't believe that, you know, Trump, we've heard Trump say that, you know, that he's not going to pass a federal ban, but we also know that with the Senate being in the Republican majority and, you know, not knowing the House yet, it's a very real possibility that a bill could be taken to Donald Trump's desk. And I personally don't believe that it would not be signed. And so while I'm excited that, you know, while I'm excited that there's been ballot measures passed, extremely excited that ballot measures have been passed, I'm very scared about what's to come, and we'll just have to watch and see.
And Kristen, what can we all do to support you and the others who are having a really tough time right now, given what just happened with 71 million people? Even if they support abortion, they have just voted for forced birth.
Yeah, I agree. I think that as John had alluded to, like, it's going to take people organizing together and continuing moving forward. And I think that this has shown us that whoever believes in this and wants to help protect women's right to reproductive health care, I think that everyone's going to have to look for opportunities on how to organize in this space moving forward. We can't give up. We have to, we just have to band together. And I think that we're going to have to be almost innovative in our thinking and think, how can we go at this differently? Because like I said earlier, sharing stories didn't get us there. So what do we need to do moving forward? How do we need to pivot in our thinking of how we go after this and just not give up? And also, if you know anybody personally impacted by this, or any woman that you know that was trying to stand up and protect women's freedoms, check on them today, because we're not okay. Everybody's very sad, very broken, and confused on what happens from here. Mm.
Well, thank you so much, Kristen, for joining us. I know it's such a tough day for you and so many others, but we so appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your thoughts and your story.
Yes, again, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We'd love to reconnect. Kristen Anaya is from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and she has told her devastating pregnancy story, which you can read about online. At 16 and a half weeks, her water broke, and she began to lose amniotic fluid. She was told by her doctors that her pregnancy could not continue, but she could also not receive an abortion because her unborn daughter still had a heartbeat. She became septic. Her life was in danger. She spent 22 hours in the hospital. It took another 5 days to recover from the sepsis infection. And she's one of the plaintiffs in the Zurawski versus State of Texas. They just wanted clarification of the medical exception. And in May, the Texas Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to issue one. So huge thanks to Kristen for joining us. Coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with Professor Michelle Goodwin, Chair in Constitutional Law and Global Health Policy at Georgetown Law School, co-faculty director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. She's host of the podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin and author of the book Policing the Womb. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent with The Nation. He's written many, many books. His latest is a bestseller. He co-wrote it with Senator Bernie Sanders called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. This is your call. We'll be back after this. I think we all need to take a deep breath. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are going to just continue doing shows about this in the weeks to come. What happened last night? There are so many layers to this. We're just going to open the lines to get your take on what happened. How do you want us to cover all of this? What guests do you want us to have on? What angles do you want us to take? We would love to hear from you. Again, we're really lucky to have an hour to dive into these issues. So we just want to use that time with you, and we'd love to get your thoughts on how you want us to use this hour. You can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, how do you make sense of what happened last night? I mean, when you look at the map, it is mostly red. The Republicans gained ground in even blue states. And as I mentioned in the intro, and it's worth repeating, Democrats gained ground in 2020. They expanded their share of votes across the country. But 90% of counties swung back to Republicans in 2024. So what are your thoughts about this? What explains this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We're joined today by John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation. Professor Michelle Goodwin is Chair in Constitutional Law and Global Health Policy at Georgetown Law School and Co-Faculty Director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. Let's hear from a listener who's been waiting patiently. Let's go to Casey in San Francisco. Hi, Casey. Welcome to the show. Hello, do we have Casey? Kevin, do we have Casey? Well, Casey, sorry about that. I know it took us a while to get back to you. If you're still listening, oh, are you there?
I'm there.
Oh, hi.
Okay. Hi. Good morning, ladies. Good morning, Miss Michelle Goodwin. I'm so glad that you're here. You know, the first thing I want to say, Rose, is I would like you to have probably Carol Anderson on this show. I'd like to hear from her. It would be very interesting because I believe that her and the doctor here, Michelle, sees it the same way. When you talk about connecting links, it doesn't necessarily start or end, good, bad, right, or wrong, with women. It's a much bigger picture than that. And a lot of it has to do with the superior supremacy to that of which we witnessed last night with Donald Trump. And the complete takeover, you know, of the need or the desire, you know, to what? Control every and all, right down to controlling women. And it won't start or end there, I feel, within the context of how supreme supremacy works. Because you pick on the women today, and it will come around to the men. It'll be something with them. You know, inevitably, it's going to catch up. It's not just women. It's a bigger picture than that. And so, but this is where you start, because you have to start somewhere with somebody. And women, I agree with the doctor, you know, they weren't always thought of as second-class citizens, like the slave and anybody else. So let's start there. And then we'll work our way around, you know, the globe with this kind of, in that context of control, to control education. As far as education is concerned, which I agree with the doctor too, is that Americans don't know enough. They're not really educated enough because they're kind of unclear, because there's a lot of education that has been, how shall I say, they're being separated from. And so in the separation, you see, they don't have all the facts. They don't have all the facts of the links that need to be connected. They don't know, with those facts, education, last night, how to even vote. Who to vote for.
Well,
why
you brought
not
up-
vote? You know,
you brought up a number of points there, Casey, and I mean, we're going to do shows about everything you brought up there. I mean, an entire show just about misogyny, sexism, and women. And Professor Goodwin, I mean, you do a show about this. You've written books about this. this is a tough one because I just saw this video yesterday from the Anti-Psychopath Pack, and they have all of these women who've been sexually harassed by Donald Trump. I've never heard of these women before. And the stories they share are so brutal. We all know this, that he's done this. So what are your comments?
Well, again, if we understand this in a historical context, and I've found that it's really important to connect this to history dating back to 2015 when the former president was running, now the president-elect, and I thought, well, really what we're missing is a historical analysis that helps us to ground this moment, especially given the deep divides that we haven't seen since the time of the Civil War. And so when I think about then what this all means for women, we have to understand that women weren't always citizens, women of any hue. White women weren't considered citizens. White women couldn't vote. They couldn't own credit, you know, like and any other woman, right? But to just think about up until recent decades, marital rape was legal. You could kidnap your ex-wife and you could engage in gang rape. And you would be exempt from prosecution because marital rape was nothing that could be prosecuted. Judges were not willing to prosecute it. There were laws that specifically exempted husbands from raping from being criminally punished for raping their wives, even if they were separated, divorce had been filed. To so many, that would seem just unheard of. That's so strange. I mean, we have the rule of thumb and we talk about it so innocently, but the rule of thumb was about being able to beat your wife and be spared from any civil or criminal punishment so long as the limb that you used or piece of metal that you used was no thicker than your thumb. I mean, and it's only been in recent years that we've bothered to pay attention to that. And so when we think about histories of sexual violence, you know, in the Dobbs decision, Justice Alito referenced those authors of the treatises who instantiated these notions in American law that marital rape was more illusory than real, that it couldn't happen because women were consumed within the identities of their husband. And, you know, just in the months leading up to the 2016 election, which I include in the epilogue of my book, Policing the Womb, I talk about sexual violence and I talk about rape. You know, there was a judge, Judge McKeon in Montana, who in a case that involved a father who serially raped his daughter, meaning he frequently did it, and the girl was 12 years old at the time, and he took a plea deal for 25 years when he could have been sentenced to 100. The judge in that case reduced the sentence to 60 days. And the argument was that the father that his sons would miss him. And so this was a reason why he should not serve any jail time, anything more than 60 days. Now, I'm sure people will want to look that up and to see, is Professor Goodwin right that there could be a father who admits to having raped his daughter since she was just a little girl and doing it regularly, weekly? Mm-hmm. And the judge would say 60 days is enough. That's the country that we live in. So when we're thinking about Donald Trump and the many women that have alleged that he is sexually assaulted and he's been convicted of this, or he's at least been civilly, right, punished for this or recognized for that, it's not new. We live within a space where we are still on the march towards women's full incorporation, their full citizenship in this country. And I know that's hard for some people to recognize, but it is a reality.
You're reminding me of Hadley Duvall, another woman, brave, brave young woman who shared her story about being raped by her stepfather. I played
Kentucky. Yeah.
Yes, out of Kentucky. An amazing story. I hope there's a Washington Post piece called Everybody's Daughter, the Rape Victim Behind Kentucky's Viral Abortion Ad. It's a tough read, but really important. We've got a related comment. So let's go to Gordy in Sausalito. Hi, Gordy. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's time for the women of the nation to withhold sex. It was done very effectively in Iceland. If the men think that they can control, they can't. And it's time to voice your power and stop sex.
Well, John, I'm wondering, when we did all of our Project 2025 shows,
yep,
one thing that continually came up from our guests who took the time to read that 900-page document, some of the things they said were so far out, and they said, I get it. It is hard for your listeners to grasp some of this. People think that can't happen here. I mean, as Professor Goodwin said, oh, this has been happening here. A lot of this has been happening here. Mm-hmm. But it's so, I think a lot of people, they think of The Handmaid's Tale and they think white Christian nationalism. That can't happen here. For people who do not know their history, and we really need to learn more about our history for so many reasons. But how far, John, do you think these Republicans are going to go, given, well, they have a mandate, frankly? How far will they go on these issues of controlling women? I mean, I think about that Tucker Carlson recently said, well, you know, when your daughter comes home and I'm you know, kind of misquoting here. I don't know the whole quote, but he talked about how you need to really hit your daughter.
Look, the Republicans won an election. And I would never in any way want to diminish the devastating impact of that election result for a lot of folks immediately and as the next few years go on. But I would remind you that the exit polls from that election showed that something like 55% of Americans, especially in battleground states, thought that what Donald Trump was saying went too far, that it was too extreme. The positions Republicans have taken on a host of issues was way over the top. What that means is that people, in some cases, maybe they really wanted the extremism, but in some cases, people voted for something that they didn't really want, but for whatever reason, they felt it was the better alternative. I really want to remind people, though, that as we look at this moment, it is so easy to get overwhelmed by it, but we should understand that in Kentucky, where Donald Trump won a landslide victory yesterday, 65%. Two-thirds of Kentuckians rejected school vouchers, rejected school choice, and voted to defend public education in a statewide referendum. And they did so after a big campaign, I mean, people pushing on all sides, and they rejected a position that is obviously embraced by many Christian nationalists. Similarly, as has been pointed out in this show, across this country, people voted for abortion rights. Majorities of people, and in some cases, very large majorities, voted for abortion rights, a position also rejected by Christian nationalists. In Missouri, in Alaska, very red states, there were overwhelming votes for all sorts of minimum wage increases and labor rights and protection on the job, positions that are, again, rejected by certainly corporate and also in many cases the Republican elites. Across the country, we see that voters actually are sending mixed signals, and sometimes voters who are clearly Trump voters, but then voting to protect public education, clearly Trump voters, but are voting to expand labor rights, clearly Trump voters who are voting to expand and protect abortion rights. And so what we have to do is educate, talk, get engaged with people, sometimes people we don't agree with, and begin to point out those disconnects, those dichotomies. It will not be easy. It has never been easy. And the fact of the matter is our history in this country tells us that we often take two steps forward, one step back, sometimes one step forward, two steps back. It is an ongoing struggle. But the fact of the matter is that the people who I've always respected politically, the people who've taught me a lot, people like Rebecca Solnit in the Bay Area, will tell you that you can't operate on naive optimism or naive cynicism. What you have to have is a genuine hope. And that hope, even in the most difficult of times, tells us that we want certain things. We want a fair and free country with economic and social and racial justice. We want to save the planet. We want peace. And I think most people do want that. But we have to find ways to frame it, to talk about it. And if we have setbacks, we have to keep working toward it. Rebecca Solnit wrote a brilliant book, Hope in the Dark, right? And there are times like this, which are really, really tough. I understand that. And boy, I'm feeling it. But those are the times I see when I look at history. Those are the times quite often where the greatest organizers, the greatest visionaries, and the next generation of members of legislatures and Congress and even presidents come from. Remember, many people like AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, others, many of them were inspired by Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016, but they were also inspired by Donald Trump's election in the fall of 2016, and they chose to get into politics, and I would argue they are in many cases transforming our politics, even in this difficult moment. So my
John,
sense is...
I want to jump in because we have so many emails, and we're learning that Vice President Harris has called Donald Trump to concede the election, and she is going to give a concession speech at 1 o'clock Pacific time. I really want to ask you both about the Democratic Party here. We're getting a lot of emails from people who are very angry. Suzanne says, when Kamala Harris started campaigning with Liz and Dick Cheney and was endorsed by John Bolton, that did it for me. Dick Cheney is a war criminal. The other thing was at the convention, failing to allow a Palestinian to speak. A number of people are writing about just the Democratic Party's failures on these issues. Chris writes, neoliberals never learn. Lonely men hate women. The planet is toast now. Authoritarians are terrible at managing complex societies. We've got another one saying the Democrats have utterly lost. What is happening with this party? Art, my perception is that the Democratic Party has let down the working class and their families. Because they're only concerned with their members' political survival in a very selfish and self-serving way. Sue writes, I don't hear nearly enough Americans talk about what I've been saying for decades, that an enormous number of eligible voters on the broad left just do not vote. And I think about the Poor People's Campaign. They say there are 140 million low-income and poor people in this country. And if a politician actually cared about the poor and talked about the poor, you could get more people to vote. So again, we're going to spend days and weeks and months talking about all of this. But Professor Goodwin, we're just getting a lot of people really slamming the Democratic Party. Some people are saying, what was Kamala Harris's message on the economy other than offering to help people buy a home with $25,000 and help people start a business? What are your thoughts? There's a lot there.
Yeah, you know, people are frustrated, and it's not unusual when there has been death even, you know, that people, they go through a process, and that process isn't only grieving. There's a way in which there's blame that is assigned. In the short period of time that she was a candidate, she ran a very, very strong and impressive campaign. There's a way of looking at this, which is that for the first time you had a country place over 66 million votes towards a black woman leading the nation. This is only the second time that there has been a woman as a candidate of a major party. The very first time that we've had a woman as a vice president. Over the coming days and weeks and months and even years, there will be critique about this. But let's be clear. On one hand, for all that could be assigned against Kamala Harris and the Democrats, you have on the other side of that things that the former president and now president-elect has said about wanting to punish his political rivals, about wanting to incarcerate them, about violence that should be directed towards them, about freeing the insurrectionist once he is president, the desire to be an authoritarian, a dictator, a totalitarian, all of these different things. So for all of the critiques that could be had, let's hold it up alongside what Americans then chose to embrace and how they voted. And I think that the two really don't align and match up for all of the critique that one might have of the Democratic Party or of Kamala Harris. Compare that to what the president-elect has said, and it's very unconstitutional, right? It smacks of denying civil rights, civil liberties. It smacks against what most Americans believe of their government, of their country, and the country that they say they want to have for their children.
John, your final thoughts based on the emails that we received, I can't even read all of them. There are so many coming in, and we have about a minute left.
I may not even take the whole minute. First off, I agree with the professor. It's so easy to point fingers of blame at an individual or you know, however you want to do it. The bottom line is that is a problem in the Democratic Party, it does need to change. It needs to figure out how to make that connection between the votes for abortion rights, raising the minimum wage, economic and social and racial justice, education in referendums, to the actual campaign for office, right? To win power at a legislative or executive level. And so there's real work to be done. And what I'll tell you is that work is already happening. I'm talking to people all over the country who are organizing and thinking. There was a great statement, and I'll close with it, from Greg Kassar, who is the congresswoman from Texas, very progressive congressman, who took a lot of bold stance. And he said, what do? We organize, care for each other, and fight back through the fear and anger. We build a new Democratic Party that is for all working people, unafraid to confront billionaires and corporate greed. We defeat Trump and Trumpism, not in one election, but with one movement. I think that's a pretty good statement. I'll rest on that.
John Nichols is National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. His latest book, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Professor Michelle Goodwin is Chair in Constitutional Law and Global Health Policy at Georgetown Law School and co-faculty director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. She's the host of the podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin and author of many books, including Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Professor Goodwin and John, thank you so much for joining us.
Honored to be with you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. Again, we're going to be doing shows about what happened last night for the days and weeks to come, and we would love to hear how you'd like us to cover these issues. What guests would you like us to have on? How would you like us to discuss how we got to this place and where we're going? You can email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.